If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's a rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Here are your hosts, Ed Mate and Lewis Harry.
All right, we're back for another edition of Spirit of the Game. I am so delighted. This is Ed Mate coming to you live from our podcasting studio. We have some very special guests today. I'm amazed our calendars worked because these two are very busy, both playing golf, officiating, and that is the one and only Bob and Christy Austin, or Christy and Bob. I don't know what the right order is. The first lady and first gentleman of the rules of golf in the state of Colorado. Thank you guys for coming in.
Well, thank you for having us, Ed. It's our pleasure and honor.
Well, when we do these monthly talks, mainly Lewis and I, I'm apt to get a couple of comments, and usually one of them's from Bob Austin. So I appreciate it. I've always said we have one listener, and maybe two now. We're gonna win over another listener here.
I do listen to your monthly podcast.
Well, thank you for that. All right, one thing I heard. Recently, we do have to set the stage, but what I heard recently is get right to the best question. Don't wait around. So I'm not going to delay. I'm going to go right in there. But we do need to explain for those that aren't in the inner circle who you guys are. So let's start with you, Christy. Tell us about your background in golf and how you became involved with the USGA and rules officiating specifically.
How much time do you have, Ed? No, yeah. I didn't play the game till I got married. So I got married in 1982, took up the game, started playing and competing shortly after that. And I still do when I have time. But I got involved in rules and the USGA when I was admitted to the board in 2007. I had never officiated before that.
The board of the USGA.
The board of the USGA.
Which is a pretty prestigious thing. Well, not very many people get... it's not like a board of 100. It's a board of very small.
Yeah. It is. And it was pretty shocking that I was asked. But I think I brought things to the table that they maybe hadn't seen from at least the four women that preceded me. So I was the fifth woman in 114 years. Now there's more women that are actively involved. But back then it was pretty rare. But as you can relate, my very first rules assignment once I was on the executive committee was Augusta. I went to Masters, and I'm sitting in the rules meeting, and they hand out the assignments. And lo and behold, Christy Austin is assigned to the 18th green on Sunday by myself. And I looked around and thought, this has got to be a typo. I mean, do they know who I am? But I'm not. So I quickly recruited the head of the Japanese tour, who was on the second hole, to come sit with me after his hole was completed. So
very smart.
Yes, half the round I had an expert sitting next to me. So I quickly realized if I'm going to officiate at this highest level, I better get good at the rules.
What year was that?
That was 2007.
Okay, yeah.
So in 2008, I went to my first rules workshop.
So you actually were doing that even before you'd been to a rules workshop? Wow.
And then 2009, I was expert qualified. So I really stepped it up quickly because...
That'll get you motivated.
Exactly. Okay. And so I've been officiating... USGA Championship since 2007. I've done 70 as of today and 72 at the end of this year. I have two more to go. So I've done it a lot and I still enjoy it. And even after I rolled off in 2013, I'm still actively involved. I do two or three or four a year. Mm-hmm. And it's fun because Bob and I do it together. So we coordinate some of our trips, some of our championships as we can. And this year, we were fortunate enough to go to the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. Yeah. We just got back from Pinehurst doing that together.
Okay. Really, well, I'm going to have a lot of questions about that. So.
Okay.
Okay. Now, that's a tough act to follow, Bob. I know you're used to it. But tell us about how you started in golf. I imagine you started before you married Christy. But tell us about how you started and how you got involved in the rules.
Yeah, I grew up playing. I was fortunate. played since I was a little kid. And always loved the game and was always very interested in the rules. And as far as the rules side, about 2003 or 2004, there was a 3.5-day rules workshop in Denver, and a friend of mine said, geez, they have this three-day rules workshop. And I thought, well, I'm pretty good at the rules. I think I've got to go to that workshop. And I did, and I got slaughtered. And as most people do the first time they're at the workshop. But I thought I could be pretty good at this. And so I started kind of doing a couple little events and studying the rules really hard. And the third year I went to rule school, I got a 99. And I, through a connection that I knew, a gal asked me to officiate at the Women's Amateur Public Links in Wisconsin. So I was invited to that and went to the Women's Amateur Public Links and then got on the Women's Amateur Public Links Committee. I was one of the first three men that ever served on a ladies committee at the USGA. And from there, I went to the junior and, you know, I just keep still working hard. And and at this point, I've worked not as many as Christy, but I've worked around 55 USGA events. And then we also work five or six college events. And we've worked, I think, 10 to 12 NCAA finals, both for the D1 women and the D1 men. And we, Christy ran a regional this year, and I ran a regional a few years ago. So we're very involved in the, and we travel to various places, but we also do the Palmer Cup, and we also do the international team. So, you know, we're blessed that we travel around. And as Christy said, most of the events we go together, but not all. But I still love the study of the rules. I've been to rule school 20 years in a row, work very hard at it. It's nice to have Christy to bounce ideas off of. But, you know, one thing in my golf is I'm the head golf coach at Kent Denver High School. And this is, I'm going into my 20th year of coaching. So in the first Monday in August, the high school season starts. And so for August and September and a week or two in October, I don't officiate. I'm all in with Kent Denver, and that's my number one priority. And I drive my players absolutely crazy trying to teach them about rules. They never quite like that.
I'm sure they love that, yeah.
But it's you know, we're very blessed, and you know, the whole experience of the friends that we've met through the USGA and the NCAA and the associations. And I want to talk later about, we saw two of those that you had mentored along the way. Nice. At the U.S. Open. So I will talk about that a little later. Yeah. But first of all, Ed, we really appreciate you being here. We know you've served on the Rules of Golf Committee, and you're certainly one of the rules minds and one of the people in golf we look up to greatly. So it's a big honor for us to be here with you.
That's very nice of you. Boy, there's so much there to react to, but let's as I promised, I wanted to jump in with maybe the best question that most of our four listeners now want to hear. You just came back from the U.S. Open, so let's talk about Pinehurst a little bit, but I'm going to even go back. Did you have anything happen there? So this is a two-part question. I'm going to start with Christy, and then we'll go to Bob, and we'll mix this up to keep you on your toes. What rulings did you – first of all, just talk about being at Pinehurst. You can answer that, I guess, you know, how the whole process works, how you're assigned to holes. I've had the good fortune of being on your email list, so I get a nice insight. Not everybody gets those. And then any rulings you made. And then I want you to be thinking, so I'll plant the seed, the most nervous you've ever been as a rules official. So that's really my first question. But I want to start with Pinehurst because we just wrapped up a U.S. Open. So just talk about your experience there.
Sure. We received our assignments a few days before we headed out, and so we knew what holes we would be on. And what they do is assign you a position on a hole. If it's a par three, you're the only one on there. Sometimes on a par four, you're the only one on there. Typically par fives, there's somebody in the landing area and somebody on the green. So I had a landing area the first day, and I had lots of rulings on. It was the fourth hole. Pinehurst is a very interesting golf course from aesthetically. I think if your listeners have viewed the coverage, there's just bunkers everywhere. And mm-hmm. some of them are bunkers and some of them are waste areas. And sometimes they're connected. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the rules challenges that we faced that week. I worked par three, and I worked two other holes where I was on the green. So I had a lot of viewing of players finishing their holes on the greens, which is always really interesting. Typically, that we didn't have a lot of rulings there other than TIOs. There was a lot of TIOs, but they were set back.
What are TIOs, honey?
Oh, do you not know that? I'll tell you. A TIO is a temporary immovable obstruction, and the grandstands and the camera stands and the lots of cabling are all considered objects that are in the way but aren't typically a challenge on a golf course. So we grant players relief if they have interference or line of sight interference. So anyway, grandstands were really the main thing, but they were set back enough and there was long grass in front of them that they didn't get back there that often. But the bunkering on four, I gotta just tell you real quickly about a couple of rulings I had since you asked. I had a number four fairway landing area on the first day, and on the right side of the fourth hole, there's two large bunkers separated by a saddle that's sand, so that's waste area. So it's bunker.
All contiguous.
All contiguous.
Yeah.
Bunker, waste area, bunker. And I can't tell you how many balls were borderline on the line where it would be maybe bunker or maybe they could ground their club because it was waste area. So after I watched this hole being played out in the first few groups that came through, and by the way, we had that one all day. Mm-hmm. So two rounds. So we were out there a long time. I would just tend to, if I saw a ball that was questionable at all, I would walk over, look at the ball. And as the player was walking up, and by the way, one of the players that was in this situation was Dustin Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I said, Dustin, your ball is not in the bunker. And the players appreciated that. It's sort of a proactive
Particularly Dustin Johnson.
Particularly Dustin, right.
A little history there with bunkers.
You know, sometimes you wait until you're asked a question, but I knew that if I were a player and I was in a situation where I didn't know, I would like to know. Yeah. And I wouldn't have to go around and look around for an official and call somebody over for that. So I took a fairly proactive approach and said, your ball's in the bunker or your ball's not in the bunker. And they just say, thank you.
And how did you determine that? Was there...
There's a pretty distinctive line.
Yeah.
Where, and of course, the waste area is not maintained.
Right.
And the bunkers are maintained, right? So in the morning, and then the caddies maintain them throughout the day. You can tell when they're in the bunker, but there was a couple of times when it was on the edge of the bunker and the waste area, and typically those weren't maintained. So it was a judgment call for sure, but you could pretty much.
But you could be in a situation where it's right on that cusp. And the ball's in a footprint, or I guess that wouldn't matter. You still have to deal with it either way. But there might be a significant advantage or disadvantage, depending on where you are.
Yeah, and one of the things that I struggled with watching that hole play out, and I called the PGA Tour professional, Stephen Cox, who was my rover. I said, Stephen, that waste area in the middle is really getting beat up. There's just tons of footprints because they were throwing the rake on the other side not in the fairway side, but the waste area side. So the players would wander, not the players, the caddies would wander through this saddle, grab the rake, but they weren't correcting their footprints at all. So it got worse and worse and worse. So by the end of the day, if you were in that saddle, you typically had a very bad lie.
And did that happen?
Yes, it did happen. And so I had a theoretical discussion with him about what should we be doing?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, Christy, we can't maintain all these waste areas. Yeah. We just let them
just
go.
Let them.
But I did talk to another rover. This is why it's subjective. I talked to another rover later, and he said, I probably would have tidied it up a little bit.
Yeah.
So there's a difference of opinion.
Interesting.
There.
Yeah. Bob, what was your experience at this year's Open?
You know, I had some interesting ones. And, you know, first of all, when you go to an Open, there's just a lot of stuff on the golf course. There's the rope lines, and there's concession stands, and there's tee markers, and there's everything. And one of the challenges as the rules official is some of those are movable obstructions, and some of them are immovable obstructions and temporary. Some of them are temporary immovable obstructions, and some of them are just integral where you're just playing it. So at that level, you better get it straight. But I had a very interesting ruling. I had a player – Luke Clanton, who was an amateur, who was, I was sitting on the 10th hole, that embedded the ball in the sandy area off the fairway, but right in one of those, what were those plants called?
The wire grass.
The wire grass, right in the middle of the wire grass. He must have hit the shot, high shot, and it just went straight down, and it was embedded into this wire plant. Well, as you know, that if it's in a sandy area, not cut to fairway height or less, you do not get free relief for an embedded ball. And so he came over and the caddy came over, and we know Luke a little bit from his college days, and I denied relief for an embedded ball. Well, he wanted a second opinion. His caddy really wanted a second opinion. So I called it. Guess who came in as my rover and gave me a second opinion? Pete Liss.
How about that? Small world.
Pete Liss, who came in, who is on tour and certainly one of the alums, Ed Mate had hired him and mentored him. And, you know, a few years later, he's out on tour. And so he came over and took him about 5 seconds and said, we're playing everything off the fairway as a sandy area, so no relief.
Yeah.
But then, so he was sort of grumpy about it, but he decides to play it, and he takes this mighty swing at it, and he hits it over a corporate hospitality hut that was probably 60 feet high. I mean, he hit that ball, and he's 50 yards, 40 yards from the green, and he probably hit it 70 yards over the green.
Wow.
And I was worried because there was a lot of other stuff back there if we couldn't find the ball. You know, what we're going to do, and is it, do we have virtual certainty it's somewhere, or are we just playing stroke at distance, which would be challenging.
But he found it?
We found the ball, and Pete came cut over, and I didn't need his help now.
Group
Pete
was on the clock now.
right. Yeah. And so I helped him, you know, on the temporary movable. That's a temporary movable obstruction where you get relief to the side. More than one club length, less than two, is a pretty easy. Once I found the ball, it was actually a pretty easy ruling. But it was kind of fun. It kind of fun to bring in Pete, who, you know, he certainly, you know, glows when I mention your name, Ed.
Oh, that's nice. So, I teased it, so we might as well. I'm going to guess, Christy, maybe that first Masters was when you were most nervous. You've 70 championships later. You know, I know what it's like, and I know that you're definitely. My rule of thumb is I don't want to become famous because there's no such good thing as a famous rules official. If you become famous with clubs in your hand, that's great. But when you become famous with a radio in your hand, that is not good.
It's really infamous.
I always say, you know, I always use the term Motorola rights. Anything you say can and will be held against you when you get on that radio. So anything come to mind for, I'll start again
with
you, Christy.
Well, I think you're right. I think the most nervous, I mean, I don't really get nervous anymore because I'm confident that I know, and if I don't know, I've got professional rovers right there.
Right.
But was at Augusta on the 18th hole that when I had balls all the time in somebody's lap or in one of those chairs or leaning against the chair. So I was constantly moving gallery, mm-hmm. constantly have players either drop or place depending on where the ball was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so just being in that limelight was nerve-wracking because it was my first game.
Yeah.
I've had some interesting rulings. I had one at the Open Championship at Royal Lithium with Jimenez,
mm-hmm.
and he's an interesting character. I've walked with him enough at senior championships that he speaks English.
Yeah.
But when he hit his ball, he embedded his ball, and we were not playing. This was back in the day.
Yeah.
They had a difference of
right
embedded ball in closing mown areas or everywhere. The tour, the European tour played, if you embedded your ball anywhere, you're going to get relief. Hmm. Well, this was the RNA. This was the championship that did not play that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the players don't really know. They don't read the notice notice to competitors. So he embedded a ball, and he's literally got his fingers almost to the ball. And I said, Angel, are you identifying your ball? Because I'm afraid he's going to lift it without mm-hmm. having any reason to lift it. And then we got another situation, right? Another problem. He looks at me crazy, like I'm crazy. He said, you're identifying your ball, right? And he said, yeah, yeah. And so he lifted and says, yeah, but I'm gonna move it. I'm gonna take relief. Well, you're not entitled to relief. We have to replace that ball. And he about, you know, took my head off.
Yeah.
And I was trying to explain to him why. And I said, would you like a second opinion? He said, absolutely. And of course, he didn't speak English for a while when I'm in the middle of talking to him. Yeah. But now Slugger comes over and says, Slugger, I'm afraid Christy's right. You don't get relief. We're not playing that you get relief if you're embedded in the rough. And so now he was cursing in his language. And I had to walk with him the rest of the day. And coincidentally, David Duvall was in that same group. And of course, David and I go way back to 1990 amateur when we stayed at our house. So David and I know each other well. But I told him, I said, the best thing you can do for you is go into scoring and talk to David Rickman about this situation and how it's not equitable. And you really don't think that was fair.
Yeah.
Because soon after, as you know, they revised that rule, the embedded ball rule. So anyway, that was fairly controversial just with that player, even though I was right.
Yeah. How about, have you ever been on, I'm sure you have, but have you ever known you're on camera where there's definitely a camera on this ruling right now. I just know it. And we were aware of that.
Yes, several. Bob, what's the most famous one, I suppose? Ricky Fowler at the Walker
Cup. Yeah, she was on TV for 10 minutes with at the Walker Cup with Ricky Fowler giving him embedded ball ruling. But, you know, a lot of times, for example, you know, we're fortunate enough to, I walked in the semifinals or refereed the semifinals in the amateur, and Christy did the final, first round of the finals. And you know, there's so many cameras that if you're making a ruling there, that every, you know, it's going to be on TV. And we've also had the fortune to walk in with the finals of the women's NCAAs.
Mm-hmm.
A matter of fact, I had Jennifer Kupcho's last round where she lost in extra holes. There's a couple rulings down the stretch, and you know there's a lot of cameras around.
Right.
So you do know. And then it's also funny, Ed, when you're on TV, and I guess I was on TV with Cameron Young at the Open, you have your cell phone in your pocket, and you feel it going zip, 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 zip.
It's all your buddies. I see you, Bob.
All my friends are texting me, and I'm like, uh-oh, I must be on TV. So it gives you a little clue.
I had a ruling with Neil Shipley, who was a low amateur at Pinehurst.
That was quite a drama with the two.
Luke Clanton.
Oh, that was Luke Clanton, right down to the, yeah.
The one that, okay. Know, went over the
yeah, that wanted relief. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Neil was, hit his approach shot onto this par four, and it, as usual, on a lot of those greens, it rolled back off the green 20 yards a long ways. And he's getting ready to hit his third shot, and I'm watching him from where I'm sitting, and he's going like this, and then he stops and, you know, sort of looks at his caddy. And so now I'm heading over because I know something happened. And I'm halfway there, and he waves me over. And I know Neil from several other championships we've worked and the amateur. How can I help you, Neil? And he said, Christy, I was taking practice strokes, and my ball rotated a half a ball. I mean, it definitely moved. I said, okay. But he said, but I don't think I caused it to move. I said, okay, Neil. I said, did you ground your club behind the ball? No, I didn't ground my club, but I'm taking practice swings. And when he showed me where he was taking his practice strokes, it was fairly close to the ball, close enough that he could have caused it to move. I said, how about this, Neil? And there's a camera crew right there, and there's a cameraman watching. I said, why don't we call for video evidence and see if there's any more information that we can gather by having them take a look at it. He said, that's great. Let's do that. So I called, and meanwhile, the radio's full of pace of play chatter, and I'm trying to get in. But they radioed back and said, we do have that, and Neil, we are saying Neil caused that ball to move.
Really?
So I said to Neil, they're confirming that you caused that ball to move. And he said, okay. And I said, and it's a one-stroke penalty. We need to replace the ball. And so he replaced the ball, you know, went on to make a double, which was really unfortunate. The funny thing is he was walking, this was the 13th hole. He's walking on the 14th fairway after he's driven the ball, and he waves me over again. And he says, now, was that a one-stroke penalty or a two-stroke penalty? I said, Neil, it's only a one-stroke penalty. He He said, okay, my walking score thought it was two. I'm like, okay, all right, well, it's only one.
Was this the final round?
This was no, it wasn't.
Okay.
It was on Saturday.
Yeah.
You know, Ed, just as a counter to that, one of the most significant changes in the 2019 rules was that if a ball at rest moves, to have it be deemed that it's the player who caused it to move, it has to be virtually certain that the player caused it to move. And before then, if you went through a time that if you grounded your club, even though you didn't touch the ball, you could be deemed guilty. But
well, even if you moved a loose impediment within a club length, you were deemed to have caused it to the move.
It was.
It had nothing to do with the movement of the ball.
Right. And you know, it used to be before 2019, you were sort of guilty until you were proven innocent.
Yeah.
But that was a very significant, kind of under the radar, not very much talked about, that for a ball arrest to be moved to penalize the player, it has to be virtually certain the player caused it.
Well, and it's so interesting the way you handled that, because I think if you took 100 rules officials, all of whom are rule certified, all of whom maybe not as experienced as you are, because I think this is where your experience came in, their inclination might be, I think a lot of, first of all, the average person would say, well, no, you didn't cause it to move. You didn't. So you just, and you want to be nice. You just don't want to, but I'm not sure, again, I'm a little rusty and I haven't worked nearly as many championships as you guys have to know, and again, in this day and age of video evidence, to make that call. It never would have entered my mind to have done that. And obviously, if I was well-versed and trained, I probably would have been instructed that if you have a doubt, but I'm, you know, that's impressive to me that you got on the radio to ask that question, because I would have probably, because what I would have done in those situations is, look, I'm over here. You're the one that has to live with this. Did you cause the ball to move? And I made that ruling many times and just said, I always say, you're the one whose head's going to hit the pillow tonight. You're going to have to live with whatever decision you make.
And that's a good point. Knowing Neil and really liking Neil Shipley, he played for Ohio State. Really super nice guy, was the not the winner, but
the finalist
in the Cherry Hills AM, and we housed him in a home that was Ohio State player. So I mean, he goes way back in our life, and we love him. But my inclination at first was just to say, "Gosh, okay, Neil, you didn't cause it."
I mean, exactly.
Back in my mind, I'm like, "Oh God, I don't want this to be real. I don't want him to have moved his ball." But I knew that there was video evidence because I was watching the cameraman, and I just knew there was cameras all around him, and I just felt.
Would you have thought of that, Bob?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I actually called for video evidence with Cameron Young, brought me over coincidentally about an hour before Christie's, and he was in the deep grass, and his ball was kind of in deep grass, and he said he took a practice swing, and he hit one of the grasses, and he said, "You know, my ball wiggled, but I wasn't sure if it had moved." And I said, "Would you like me to call for video evidence?" So I had actually done the same thing. In this case, he was one of the first guys out on the course. I was on 10, and I called Craig Winter, who was on the TV broadcast, and we did not have video evidence. And so in this case, we need that virtual certainty.
Right.
And he said the ball wiggled, but he said, "I don't think it moved, but, you know, it." And I said, if a ball oscillates, it, you know, by definition is not moved. So in that case, I said, you know, no penalty, play the ball as it lies, because we had no other evidence.
Right. So I have a question that you both have had direct experience with, and I know I did, and I have a strong opinion on this, which I'll keep out for now. And that's the bedside manner or the procedure of assigning officials. So you have both worked many championships, many of which as a walking official and many now as a zone official. And I'm going to give you, Bob, first crack at this one. Tell us your experience with both and why you feel, or maybe you one is better than the other, and maybe you can explain a little bit how that works and how the old days of officiating have kind of changed.
Yeah, and prior to 5 years ago, Christy, when did they change that 4 years ago.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
5 years ago, whenever we went to an open, whether it be a women's open or a senior open or the U.S. Open, we walked with a group. We were assigned a group, and we walked with that group all day.
And by the way, just a quick, that was also true in the Open Championship. Have they also, by the way, gone to zone officiating?
I don't know because I haven't worked one in a while. But at that point, when I had had that ruling with the Menes, we were walking.
Right. Okay. Sorry, Bob. Keep going.
No. And also, now we're staged on a certain holes, or sometimes it's two holes. At the NCAA, we drive a cart, and we have two or three groups, and we're between the groups. And so it's a little bit being with a group, but not quite. But when you're – and now, as I – at the USGA events, we are stationed on a hole. And except in, you know, when one of the amateur events like the U.S. Amateur did, once it gets to match play, each match will have its own referee, which is a little bit different in match play. But, you know, the one thing about I enjoyed walking with the players a little more. You're with them. You're seeing everything that they do. You're noticing little habits, you know, their pre-shot routines and, you know, how they're marking the ball. I mean, you're paying attention and you're focused in on, you know, anything that could happen there. You're there to help. And you know, more than anything else, you're there to assist the players to help them with the rules. And now we're in on holes, which sometimes it's a little bit harder to know exactly what happened. But I know one of the main reasons the USGA went to that was because they felt like some of the players felt like if you have a official watching you, it's like Big Brother's watching you.
And the other reason that they indicated back then was that they were actually getting audience call-ins, people calling in saying, "What do you got? Why are you guys following the players? What, you know, did are you just waiting for them to do something wrong?" It's kind of like, again, Big Brother.
Yeah, the optics were not
the
friendly.
Optics weren't quite what they wanted them to be. Although I'll still to this day say that Mike Davis said, You can never do a better job than walking with a group as a referee. You just being right there, right, watching every move. That's the best way to officiate. And you know, of course, they switched that.
So, what do you think? You've done both. You've seen the overall championship and how it's conducted, not just your personal experience. That's the part that I find frustrating. It's like I had more fun walking. Well, it's not about you.
Right. It's not about you.
The other argument for walking officials that I know Mike was a believer in was pace of play, because you are now developing a rapport, if you're good at it, or at least a presence with the players that they may listen to you and say, hey, particularly if you handle it in a really diplomatic way, hey, guys, the group in front of us was just put on the clock. Just want to let you know, let's keep our position. Being proactive. You can't do that as a zone official.
Right. You know, I think we do a fine job either way, Ed. And to have the players, I think on a collegiate level, the players like when we're walking with them. I'm not sure the pros really appreciated that. And so
I'm sure they didn't.
And Ed, you make a good point. You know, it's not about us. It's about, you know, the players and the players' experience. And quite frankly, getting the rules right. But I agree with you.
Well, so when I had the good fortune of working the Masters, I was very nervous. Having worked a couple of U.S. Opens, this was, you know, the Masters. And I never worked an Open as a zone official. So I was sort of prepared for that experience at the Masters, knowing I was a pretty good idea I wasn't going to be walking with groups because I'd watched enough Masters to know that's not the case. My problem with the walking official, when I got to sites and they handed me those hole-by-hole notes, and particularly when I got better at ignoring them because, frankly, it is, like Bob said, you got all the cabling, everything down. You're talking about 20 pages of notes, a full page at least, maybe page and a half on every single hole. And you get there and you're supposed to have walked the entire golf course. And I was so nervous the entire time as a walking official because every single shot, I'm like staring at my hole by hole notes. If a shot went off the fairway, okay, what do I got? And when you're a zone official, and this is where I guess I feel strongly, I felt more competent and more prepared. I could get out there an hour ahead of time, being the kind of personality, anxious personality type. I could put a ball on anywhere and go, and then even get on, hey, bring it over. Hey, what do you think about this? So I just felt so much more comfortable and prepared to make good rulings and to be more and not have to get on the radio. Not that I, so those, that was sort of my personal experience.
Particularly in the case of these temporary movable obstructions, because a lot of times you're measuring what's the center of this TIO. I'm going to abbreviate TIO so that I know if a ball's here, I'm going to go to that side. I know if the ball's here, I'm going to go to that side. If it's not an either side relief. Yeah. So, I mean, you can do some prep work to get ready for potential rulings. And so I agree with that point wholeheartedly. Yeah. You get to be an expert on that hole.
Yeah.
And the other great thing from an officiating standpoint is you see every group come through. So you're seeing every player in the field, where if you're walking, those are your players, you know, two or three players that you're going to spend the day with. And so I think there's pros and cons both way, but I really don't have a problem being on a hole. I think that we do a fine job.
And Ed, you're exactly right that, you know, the holes that you have, especially at the Open, you go out there early and you run through in your mind, okay, if the ball's here, where are we going to be dropping it? And if the ball comes here, where do you want to go drop it? Because one thing I've learned through the years is the players don't need a rules lesson. The players want to know, where do I drop the ball?
Right.
If they're one question, where am I going to drop it? I want to go back and play. But I agree with Christy. I think, you know, being a zone official, you know, we still do a great job. And I think it's worked well.
One last sort of compare and contrast between U.S. Opens and the Masters. The thing that was a real sort of aha moment for me at the Masters was, oh, there are no TIOs here. There really are incredibly few, and they're way out of play. And all the permanent infrastructure that's there, that just it's the advantage of having a home game every year, as opposed to having to erect the city. This rodeo that you're a circus that comes to town, that makes officiating a lot easier at Augusta.
It does.
Yeah.
The other thing that's easy about Pinehurst, there were no penalty areas other than one on 16, which was right off the tee.
Yeah.
So we had no yellow or red penalty areas.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of odd, isn't it, to have a whole golf course with no
yeah.
No penalties.
I have one quick story about Pinehurst. So the USAM was there 2009, I think, the year Danny Lee won. And Mike Davis said, make sure you review the what I'll call the 2x2 local rule with sprinkler heads, because that's ubiquitous here at Pinehurst. So I figured I don't need to look at that. I mean, I'll have another beer at the cocktail party and they'll be fine. So the next day, of course, I was on 17 green and a guy waved me down to 16 green. And that, of course, was the ruling. And I confidently made the ruling. And then he asked, do I get a club length? And I'm like, oh, crap. I just had a blank. And again, the rules have changed now.
Sure.
But at the time, the answer was no. And I sheepishly got on the radio and I said, I need a backside rover. And of course, it was Mike Davis. And he recognized my voice and he said, Ed, what do you need? I said, well, I didn't do my homework. Does he get a club length? And he laughed and said, no, he does not get a club length. And we moved on. And that's why I call it your Motorola rights, because we all know these are rules experts from around the world that are on that radio listening to everything that's said. And it's intimidating. I'm not even worried about the TV as much as the people listening on the radio.
Judging you. Who was that? Who asked that question?
Yeah. And then you'll get some friendly ribbing. So, and again, I don't want to embarrass anybody. So as an example of that, last year at the Open, there was a mistake made, and we won't go into details on who it was.
Other than it was not me.
It wasn't anybody in this room.
People thought it was me. I'm like, no, it was not me.
Yeah, yeah. So what we're talking about, this was Rory McIlroy. I believe it was 14 or 15. Do you remember the hole, Bob?
It was
the par five.
It was 14.
14, his ball embedded. And by the way, I just have to say, that's why I love doing this podcast, because I can get on soapboxes anytime I want. I don't like that rules change. I don't like the club length you get when a ball embeds. It's basically a get out of jail free. I've seen it happen now many times where a player gets that additional club length. But anyway, the error that was made, and I'll just set it up and maybe you can shed some light on how this came about and maybe some things that happened that we're not aware of. But Rory's ball embedded in the grass face. So it's not in the bunker, but in the grass face above the bunker. And it was embedded, which I doubt personally. I doubt that ball was embedded because you're talking U.S. Open rough, vertical face. I know enough about gravity. It's very unlikely that ball was embedded. And I always, we don't have in grass. I mean, here's the plane of the earth. That's embedded. I don't think the plane of the earth was affected by that ball. That's just another quick soapbox. So anyway, but embedded ball. So the relief that was granted, as I understand it, what should have been measured from right behind the ball on that vertical face, but it was measured at the top of the, you know, like taking, disregarding about 18 inches or so of distance, albeit vertical distance. So the effective result was the ball was dropped in the wrong, potentially in the wrong place.
Yes.
So Ed, yeah, what we're talking about is the rule previous to the change was that in an embedded ball, you got relief and dropped it right behind the ball. Now there's a reference point right behind the ball, and you get one club length around in your semicircle. And so that's
no closer to the ball.
No closer. And so that ball of Rory's embedded in that face. And so the question is, was there any ground behind the ball? You know, mm-hmm. Depends how the earth curves. And the rules official on site did not think that there was, that there, the reference point really wasn't behind the ball. And there's a new clarification that says if there's not a reference point directly behind the ball and the reference point cannot be in the bunker, it must be in the general area, then you find your nearest point in the general area, which becomes the reference point, mm-hmm. correct? And so she, who's one of our closest friends, and let me just say, she is a great rules official. Just yeah. on that particular time, made a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
She didn't get in position to make the ruling properly. I think her mistake was she stayed on top of the bunker
yeah.
and felt around.
Right.
She didn't get in the bunker to see,
yeah.
you know, level
right.
what was behind that.
Right, right.
But you know, going back to being nervous, you know, you're on the 14th hole at the Open. There's so many cameras, and well, you've got
and
the
Rory's
lead
group. And Rory's in the hunt. Yeah.
And Rory's in the hunt.
That's as big a spotlight as you're ever going to find. And what I had heard, and again, who knows if this is true, but I can totally see, you mentioned with Neil Shipley, you're trying to break through on the radio, and you can't get through. So maybe she asked for a rover, and I can't get a rover. I think, like I said, I'm going
to
avoid.
She had her earpiece out. They were trying to talk to her.
Ah, okay.
And she had her earpiece out. And a lot of people pull it out. They told us, do not pull out your earpiece while you're trying to make a ruling. We may be trying to get in touch with you.
Yeah, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, Ed, when you're making rulings, especially when you got TV and mm-hmm. they're yapping on the radio about something else, mm-hmm. it can be you're trying to focus in on what you're doing.
No, exactly.
And
you want to give your full attention to the player and listen to what they're saying and so forth.
But at the end of the day, she allowed Rory the reference point, which was not where it should have been, and Rory was able to drop it 18 inches closer to the hole. Or
I think determined it was 12 inches, but it doesn't. Regardless, he had a better.
All
place
I know
for
is
his feet.
All I know is ruling correct or not. You know, because again, the statement the USGA put out, and we don't have to dwell on this anymore, was that it really didn't affect. Now it might have affected the stance. Instead of having to stand, he ended up making bogey. But again, I really don't like that rule anymore because I do think it presents too many opportunities for a get out of jail free. Okay, so it's a little transition here into another fun question. Do you find that most rules officials now are friendly and have their attitude is I'm here to help, not they're kind of a little bit more, this is about me and I've risen to the top of my game and I need respect, or what is your...
My take on the group that we associate with is that the younger they are, the more friendly and a different approach mm-hmm. is taken. I think some of the old school guys are still pretty stoic
mm-hmm.
and don't approach it. I mean, I always walk up to a player and say, how can I help? That's my first question.
Right.
How can I help?
Right.
That's what I'm, you know, that's what I'm there to do is to help them. And I don't think that's the same approach that some of the other guys use. I don't know, Bob, do you have an opinion?
Yeah. You know, Lou Blakey, who is a tremendous mentor of mine, you know, always said, walk into a ruling slowly and confidently and ask in a very nice, slow way. You know, he always says, may I be of assistance? And that's what Lou would always say. And he said, you know, it's important to approach each rule like, hey, you're here to help. You're not rushing through it. And I think it is I think it is important to be, you know, friendly and the player really believes that you're trying to help them.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Christy, too, in terms of the general trend. There was a gotcha mentality, I think, in the past of, you know, tough luck. Bad luck starts somewhere, stops right here. You know, some of these one-liners that, you know, again, as at the cocktail hour afterward, kind of this braggadocio of how I denied this player relief and look at me. And speaking of that, as far as how to tell a player bad news, and maybe you have your own ideas on this. I was watching a European Tour event one morning early, and I don't know who the official was, but a player was asking for relief, much like Angel Jimenez, and the official was not able to grant relief, and he said, there's nothing I can do for you under the rules. And I put that in my little toolkit, and I said, you know, that might be useful someday. And I've used it a couple, not often, but because that's a wonderfully friendly way of saying, I'm here to help you, but I'm not going to cheat for you.
Right. Yeah. What's our button say that?
Yeah, we have a button. Jim Moriarty, our Fed, gave us his button. We wore it a lot of college tournaments. It's not personal. It's the rules of golf. So we did not wear it at the USGA events.
No.
But, yeah, they probably frowned on that.
But the guy that's the second in charge of the NCAA rules gave it to us. So we felt, and we got some comments on that button.
Oh, the players actually liked that. I like that.
The coaches did too. Good. Yeah, they thought that was funny.
That is good. My very first rules seminar, one of my first, Ken Lindsay did, and he said, you know, I've been officiating for however many years, 30 years. I've never given a penalty. And everybody looked at him like he's crazy. And he says, that's because every time I issue a penalty, and he held up the rules book, this little book gives the penalty. And he was a big advocate of not using personal pronouns. And there's something to be said for that. It's not, I am denying you relief. There's no interference. That's just, there's nothing personal there. It's just, and these are the kinds of things you get better at with experience.
Sure.
And, you know, and that's true. And, you know, one of the things about going to some of these events that we go to is, you know, the discussions that we have with the other rules officials. And, you know, I think, you know, we go to an open, every official there I could learn something from, and, you know, and we talk about little things like that. And, you know, I had this ruling or I had that rule. Sometimes it drives Christy. I could talk more rules in the shop than Christy can. Christy drives her crazy a little more. But you're always learning just from other player. You know, like that was interesting what you just said. Yeah. I'm going to put that in my book too.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another, I had a great conversation with Andy McPhee, who was a tour official.
Loved Andy.
Yeah. And he told me something really interesting. I'd love to get both of your takes on this, which kind of surprised me. Because the other thing I sort of noticed, the more experience you had, the more, and maybe this is not correct, the more likely it was that you might inch over the line of advice. And because I have always been so black and white on advice, and really I can't, there's what you can and can't say as an official is a really, it gets delicate at times because you really know, you know, you really shouldn't be dropping there because it's going to end up over here. So how much coaching can you give a player? And Andy told me, and then the summary of this was, there's nothing wrong with walking a player through a rules scenario. And he basically was saying, we're going to go from here to here to here. And if you're leading the witness a little bit, you know, he sees a multi-drop thing, you know, a TIO that's going to lead to a new condition. And he would have no problem saying, here, we're going to go from here to here to here and to here. And it was pretty clear that the way you made some decisions might cut to the chase.
You could go a different way.
I guess
I think Bob uses this same approach, is particularly at the collegiate level. you go and you look at the scenario, and the player's just, he has one thought in his mind, and that is, well, I have to drop it here, and that's not good, and then I'm going to have to go back. And he's walking through these things out loud with you, and you just say, would you like to know your options under the rules?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's other options.
Yeah.
You know, you want him to know you're not thinking this clearly. Yeah. And usually they say, well, yes. And so you'll go through his two or three options, and then it's kind of like, the light bulb goes off.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ed, we've all seen situations the player will ask you, can you drop here? But, you know, it's much better to take another option. One of the other options under the whatever rule it is. But for my high school team, I always say when you call a rules official or you bring someone in, always don't ask anything specific. Ask, what are my options under the rules of golf? That's the question you ask every time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if my players are listening to me, but that is certainly something that, I've taught them to say, because I think that's the right thing to say.
Well, I'll give you, again, not to dwell on this one, but the example that comes to mind for me, let's say you have a ball that enters the penalty area and abutting that penalty area is a cart path. And you're going to have a two-drop drop process. And there's a little bit of grass on either side of it. And that little bit of grass is good or it's bad. And so there's a good side of the path and a bad side of the path. And a smart player will measure their two club lengths and drop, knowing it's going to roll more than two club lengths. Or I'm sorry, roll outside. There I am using my old hat. Rolling outside of the area. And then they're going to get to place it. And now we have a new situation. And where they place that ball could have a big difference. And I'm sort of like biting my tongue to say, drop it over here at this edge, because I know where this is going, and they may or may not.
Yeah.
So that's where – and those don't happen a lot, but there are definitely times you have to be
Andy's,
careful.
Andy's approach is fine, I think.
Yeah.
We're going to go here.
Yeah.
We're
gonna
go here.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Get it?
Yeah.
And if they're not smart enough to figure that out.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, when you have those two-step rulings, a lot of times they say, "Well, can I just drop it over here?" No. Sorry.
We had that at La Costa all the time on 18, where the penalty area is the cart path line.
Yeah.
And so we're dropping on the cart path, and then the players are like, "Why are we doing this?" I said, "Well, I agree.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll shorten that someday, but."
Yep. Okay. Next topic. Rules that you would change if you were king or queen.
Mm.
I have my list of things. So as you think about, because I didn't prep you for this. One, and this isn't a rule I would change. It would be a rule I would adopt more widely. And that was at Rolling Hills this morning. They wanted some input on some course markings, which involved a round of golf, which was really fun too.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't always get to do that. And, I wish more courses, more clubs would use the alternative to stroke and distance local rule, because I think it's a really smart local rule. You lose a ball, measure equidistant into the fairway, and drop within two club lengths. And oh, by the way, it's two strokes. You're not getting, that's not, and it preserves the outcome in most cases of what would have been a provisional ball played under stroke and distance. So that's a rule that exists that I would just adopt more widely. I do have some others that I would change.
But the players don't use that, Ed. I mean, they think I'm adding two strokes.
I know, they don't. And I don't know if that's – because, again, for years, players have been doing that and adding one stroke. Yeah.
And then guess what? They still do.
When I was on the rules committee, when the rules committee first presented their – I'll call it 1.0, and I was on early in the 2019 run-up, and Mark Newell, brilliant guy, really enjoyed working with him, presented to the executive team at the USGA, and Mike Davis said, what about the alternative to stroke and distance? And at the time, he said, we haven't come up with anything. And Mike was not happy. He said, I think you need to put your thinking cap back on. And there was so many different ideas offered. And I think it's a really elegant solution. I mean, it's not perfect, but we're estimating all the time in golf where balls last cross. It's not like that's a concept that doesn't already exist. So use that same concept. Bring
but
the ball
it's not where it last crossed. It's where they think the ball
no,
is.
No, I understand, but that's fairly...
In desert golf, we have no idea.
Yeah.
A lot of times we have no idea. Or it's a dog leg.
Well, again, for pace of play and for getting around the golf course, now, is it going to use it in a high-level competition? No, but at the club level, I think it's a great local rule. Anything come to mind that you might change?
You know, a couple of them they changed this year, which would have been on my list a year ago, was now if the committee puts the wrong handicap on a scorecard.
Right.
It used to be that was the player's responsibility, and the player could get disqualified for that. Well, now that it's the committee can correct that, even in scoring, and it's not so much the onus on the player. The player still certainly has a responsibility, but that, and you know, they also are easing up. There's a local rule, one of the local rules. By the way, there's 92 local rules now.
Wow.
There's 75 pages of local rules. I think I think if my numbers aren't exact, they're pretty close. But, you know, one of the other ones was now that you can write a local rule that if you've left the scoring area, you're
They just announced that. I just saw a Craig Winter email just go out this last week that, and that's smart.
Yeah.
With it, you know, because again, just to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about, it used to be, or it still is, I guess, because this is a local rule, that as soon as you leave the quote unquote scoring area, that scorecard is officially turned in, and if it's there's an error, you're too bad. We saw that happen with Jordan Spieth earlier this year.
Yes.
Now it's if an error, you have 15 minutes. The local rule says that you have 15 minutes from the time it was, I guess, input into the computer. Is that?
I'd have to.
But anyway,
it's a little bit of get agile. It's you know, you take one step over the line, you know, you're not necessarily DQ'd, because that's always been a, you know, when you're disqualifying a player, that is a harsh penalty.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that they actually, when I was on the rules committee, I hated that if you, and this was an instance in one of the women's opens where a blade of sand was.
Yeah.
God, who was
it? I think it was was that Brittany Lincecum?
It was a
playoff,
it might have been Brittany in the playoff, but it was a European player.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, she
touched a grain of sand.
She didn't see it.
Yeah.
Didn't feel it. Didn't see it visually, and yet it impacted the outcome of that championship. Yeah. And I just said, this is not right. If a player can't even see or feel moving a blade of sand, but the high definition video can, how can we expect the player to know that?
Yeah.
And you know, there's been other instances, same kind of thing though, just so minute. Oh, back in the old days when we were in a penalty area and we would touch a loose impediment.
Yeah. Right.
So they have softened that, right? To say, no, we're not making rulings with, if we think the player cannot see or feel or, you know, with the naked eye, that is not a penalty.
Right.
But I think, Ed, too, and I'm sort of still pondering your question, but you look at, you know, the flag stick rule, how much more player friendly that is. If you're in a penalty area now, how much more player friendly that is. And I think the USGA has done an amazing job of making the rules more player friendly.
Oh, the ball moving on the green.
Oh, that's
all those
to me
instances where the
that's
ball.
That's so. That was so much. Oh,
that was just really.
Well, and
so
again,
much
that's a
equitable.
Great example. The game has evolved to the point where putting greens are like this table. I mean, they're the ball just moves so much more easily. So we needed to evolve the rule. And we were just running into this. You had the ruling with Neil Shipley. We all know it was just happening way too often. Yeah. Did that ball move? What caused it to move? Now it's like just a bright light test. Did you put it's? It is funny though how people, I don't think, fully appreciate. You still need to mark it the second time. So if you, and they always do, but if you put it up to 3 feet and it's on a precarious spot, you better mark
it.
Yeah.
And that's a, you know, a common sense rule is that, you know, you own that spot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
And it's always been that way. People, when your ball reaches the putting green, I think there's something about, when the ball's been in your hand and you put it back, that's a difference than playing the ball that arrived there on its own accord and you didn't intervene. So that just, there's a logic there. And that same logic doesn't apply when the ball's not on the putting green.
When Christy chaired the Rules of Golf Committee, she, you know, I remember one of her big one was if you can't see it, you shouldn't be penalized.
Yeah.
You know, kind of that naked eye standard. And
I want to clarify that. It's the player, you know, said they didn't see it. Well, maybe they weren't looking. But I'm talking about a situation where the player is addressing the ball, looking at it, seeing it, and, yeah. and there's an incident like the blade of sand, which yeah. was just ridiculous.
Yeah. yeah.
So anyway, we fixed that.
Yeah.
So.
yeah. But, you know, it's interesting on not, you know, all the rules. I was on the putting green with Martin Laird 2 days ago and Martin was with his kids and you know, Martin kind of pulled me over and went through this whole thing about how we shouldn't be able to fix damage on the putting green. And that it gives players advantage, and they make troughs all the way to the hole, and it delays play. And you know, Martin, and you know, he's obviously got credibility, but yeah. You know, he certainly was bending my ear.
He didn't like that. Most players like that.
He did not like that rules change. Anyway, I heard his reasons. Yeah,
that is interesting, because that was always the fear about allowing players to tap down spike marks, was that they would create this sort of trough. And you do see now, Xander Schauffele, every time his ball comes to rest near the hole, the first thing he does before he even marks it is tap, tap, tap. It's just like, I'm going to make sure there's not anything in there.
So you know, the rules will always you know, you sat on the rules of golf committee, you know, it's there's always going to be different sides of different rules.
Yeah. So, Bob, you'd mentioned earlier you had a chance during the Open to see some of our local talent that have come up. It's been so much fun to see Jennifer Kupcho. Obviously, Wyndham Clark is the defending champion in the Open. Just love to hear what that experience was.
Well, you know, Wyndham Clark saw me at the Open. I actually walked out and I said, good luck, Wyndham. And he stopped. He turned around. He must have recognized my voice. He said, thanks, Bob. How you doing? And I said, good. And I said, good luck. I didn't really get too much of a chance to talk to him. But, you know, I've known Wyndham since he's been 8 or 9 years old. And you know, when he was a high school player at Valor, he came and played in a couple of my Kent Denver invites and was always gracious enough to do that. He didn't play in too many. And you know, he's just a local kid, and I have never, I've said this 100 times, I've never seen a kid at 11, 12, and 13, 14-year-olds work that hard on his game.
Yeah.
He was so motivated and so dedicated and, you know, so proud of what he's done. And, you know, he just made the Olympic team.
Is that official?
Yes, that is official.
Wow.
Xander and Scotty and Colin Montgomery and Wyndham are officially named.
Mark Howard.
Montgomery. I don't know where I got that, but they will play for the United
That's
States
amazing.
In the Olympics,
wow.
which is a great thing. And you know, Jennifer Kupcho, certainly you could argue she's the best women player to ever come out of Colorado, and what she's accomplished not only at the college level but you know at the pro. And you know, one thing, you know, Wyndham, which goes a little bit under the radar. In college, he was there 5 years, but 1 year he was Big 12 Player of the Year.
Yeah.
And that's a great conference, Texas Tech, A&M, Oklahoma State. And another year he was Pac-12 Player.
There's probably not many players that can say that.
I mean.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, this has been every bit as much fun as I thought it would be, so much so I'm going to definitely have you back again. But before we adjourn, I would love just open mic. Christy, you've had a wonderful career. Are you just anything else that I haven't asked you that you'd like to share and all your experiences?
You know, I think the longer Bob and I do this and we're doing more and more together, the more we enjoy giving back to the game. I mean, it's really, we have time, you know, we're both retired. We love the game. We love playing the game, but more than that, we love our friendships and we love these championships. We love the staff at the USGA. So, you know, just rekindling all those relationships and being able to see the best players in the world or the best players coming up in the world is truly a gift and really, really, really fun for us.
Yeah, I feel the same way. You know, every championship you work, you feel, first of all, you know, to most of them with my wife is certainly a blessing. But from the golf that you witness, but just to experience that, but also the friendships and to be able to get to know the USGA staff and the you know, Thomas Pagel and Pete, who you mentored, were there and to rekindle and talk about those. And you become we've gotten to be very good friends with a number of our officials. And
I thought of one other benefit. We've been able to go to places we would have never traveled to. We've been to Abu Dhabi, mm-hmm. been to Paris or Versailles for the mm-hmm. World Amateur Team. We're going to La Hinch for the Palmer Cup. Wow. I mean, so we're doing all these very
you know,
cool
but also, Ed, trips. It's given me, I went to Bowling Green, Kentucky for a girls' junior, and I went to Stevens Point.
I saw you there.
That's right. I did. You were there. Ed.
I love those places, too.
But, you know, you go to exactly Bowling Green, Kentucky, and you know how proud their community is.
Yeah.
And you know, how they embrace these. In that case, it was the girls' junior.
Yeah.
How much they embrace those. And we've been to a number of those little towns.
Oh, yeah.
That you go there and you say, you know, these are just great towns and great people. And you get to know them. And you go to restaurants and you go to all these places.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I completely agree. The best part of my time doing rules officiating for USGA championships was exactly what you're saying. Senior opens in the old days when they had a transportation committee, and these volunteers in their Lexus would take you wherever you wanted to go, and you'd have a nice little Uber driver who, you know, going to Dayton, Ohio, going to Hutchinson, Kansas, and just getting to know those communities and the people is so special. And that definitely is the part of it that I probably enjoyed the most. I have one funny anecdote that I'll share that with Jim Bunch that he tells very better than I do. But before I tell you that little story, it's a lot of work. I think you guys do it as a labor of love, but I don't think people appreciate it's a lot of work. And you're out there a long time and it's hot. And and let's be honest, not everybody loves you. You're out there and you're often the bad guy, even if you do it in a friendly way. You're dealing with pace of play. You're dealing with parents who are in your ear about how could you possibly
coaches.
Yeah. Exactly. It is a lot of work and you're doing it. You're not getting paid. I don't know of any other official in any other sport that does it for free. So it's one of the most amazing things about golf in that way.
You know, you're right, Ed, that, you know, with our friends, they see you're standing and you're watching golf at the U.S. Open. But the work it took to get there, and I listened to your podcast with Lewis mm-hmm. about how hard he studies and how long he prepares for the rules of golf, the 3-day rules of golf workshops. And, you know, I was trying to get some tips, and I got some tips from him.
Yeah.
But, you know, because I do the same thing he does, mm-hmm. and we all do. And, you know, but he did a great job of talking about how much work it takes just to prepare academically.
Yeah.
And then when you're out there, how much work it is.
And that alarm goes off at 4:30, and oh, my goodness, it's not easy.
And you're there all day, and then it's
luckily,
like—
luckily, I'm an early bird.
And you're there all day, and then you're going home, and you're starved, but you don't want to eat a big dinner because you got to—
It's true. It's like 6 o'clock at night. You've had your fourth rain delay, and you're like, oh man, am I ever going to eat tonight?
And we have a saying as a rules official, sleep fast.
Well, the story I alluded to, so Jim Bunch, like you, Christy, was thrust into the as an executive committee member with very little rules experience, and he's on the 16th green at Augusta, and it's his first year, and it was a pretty benign day, and he's sitting inside the ropes in his little Augusta chair, making sure he's not in the view of the camera as we're instructed. And these guys are just having a great old time, and they're stacking up the beers. And, you know, Augusta, they're pretty well behaved, but they were not feeling any pain. And they started yucking it up with Jim, and Jim is so friendly. He's, you know, giving it right back to him. And they said, so what do you have to do to get your job? And Jim, without missing a beat, said, well, the first rule is you can't drink beer. And that was the end of that conversation.
That's classic, Jim.
Yeah,
He knew that off the cuff.
It may look like fun, but you can't drink beer. So that would not be good. Well, listen, thank you guys for this hour, whatever it's been. It's flown by. And I hope we can do this again. Yeah, so, sure.
Thank you, Ed. Really appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you for having us.
You bet.